The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to the primary source for learning about sex health issues, nearly 90% of kids say they get their information online. Doctors, friends, schools, parents, TV, magazines are all far behind. Several sex health organizations are responding by trying to engage teens and young adults on the social media channels where they live. The challenge is getting around Facebook, Twitter, and Google's strict policies on sexual content. Amber Madison is a therapist, author, and lecturer on sex ed. She wrote about how social media companies end up censoring sex health information and is petitioning them on change.org to change these policies. And she's here to explain why. Amber Madison, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Nice to meet you.
Well, Amber, it is nice to meet you. And your article looks at how health organizations are attempting to position themselves on social media. Bedsider is one of them you wrote about, this Twitter handle kind of created to educate teens about sex. So tell us a little bit about more about the voice and the mission of Bedsider.
Yep. Bedsider is a really cool sexual health, I guess, initiative. It's from the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. And their aim is to educate 20-something women about contraception, because it turns out that there are just as many unplanned pregnancies in 20-somethings as there are with teens. So when you're looking at reducing unplanned pregnancies, you have to not just focus on teen pregnancy, but pregnancy for women in their 20s as well. So Bedsider wants to be kind of the cool kids of sexual health. They want to create content that's really engaging and entertaining and build a brand that is almost like a lifestyle brand. So something that you would see in like Cosmopolitan magazine or Glamour, and something that's going to keep people coming back. But their actual mission is to educate people about safer sex and contraception.
They ran afoul of Twitter's censorship policies or policies on sexuality on Twitter. First, why and what is the policy?
So social media in general and the entire tech world have pretty strict policies when it comes to sexual health. And some places say, hey, look, you can't talk about sex at all. We don't care if it's educational or if it's health related, you can't talk about it. Twitter's policy is really interesting because it says it's okay to talk about sexual health, you just can't talk about it in a sexual way. So you can say, hey, there are free condoms at the health center, but you can't say use a condom for better sex, which is problematic because the whole problem with sexual health is that people don't view sexual health as sexy. They don't view it as part of sex. They separate the two, that either you're protecting yourself and that's weird and clinical, or you're having really hot, passionate sex. So a lot of organizations are trying to merge those two worlds to increase the use of birth control and other contraceptions. But Twitter won't allow you to say good sex life. So really, Bedsider and many other organizations, their hands are tied if they want to present themselves in a fun and entertaining way, because these policies are making them talk in incredibly clinical ways.
So what does Twitter do? Do they just take down that individual tweet?
Well, so what the policies we're talking about here is for promoted tweets. So while you do have some leeway to tweet what you want within your account, if you want to promote your account, which is the way that you would advertise on Twitter, then that's when these policies come into play. And the interesting thing is it's not just the promoted tweet, but if that tweet says something very neutral and dry, but then links back to a web page or an account where there's other information that would violate their policy, then that doesn't work either. So it means that if Bedsider wants to advertise on Twitter, not just do their Twitter advertisements need to be bland, but then every single thing on their homepage at the time has to fit into the policy that Twitter has around sex.
Is Twitter normally so stringent about promoted tweets that link back to content? I mean, do they usually look at that content?
Well, I think that that's a problem with these policies in general. And I do want to say, you know, we're talking about Twitter here, but it's not just Twitter. It's Facebook, it's Instagram, it's many other social media platforms. But the real issue is that a lot of these terms of service are written in a really vague way. So really, it's left up for interpretation by the different customer service representatives. So some things slip through, whereas other things don't, and then it's really a judgment call. So, you know, a couple months ago, there were pictures of Kim Kardashian's bare butt everywhere. And yet, when you actually want to talk about health, that's not okay. So the word sex automatically raises red flags, but content that's highly, highly sexual often will slip through. So it's really a bit of a double standard.
Well, you are speaking to a double standard, given how much smut is actually online and how much, you know, you can find on a given day and Facebook and Twitter. But it is surprising to me that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, that these organizations, the techies, kind of promoting themselves as the voice of the future, would have such conservative policies. Are they conservative?
I believe they are conservative, but I don't think it is definitely ironic, but it's not necessarily conservative idealism. I think it's more of an issue of not wanting, you know, understandably, not wanting to upset users that are more conservative, not wanting to tackle anything too controversial, most likely. And it takes work to sit down and figure out, hey, what's a policy that allows effective sex education messages through, but censors things that are more pornographic?
With so much competition from pornographic material, where are kids and young adults getting their information about sex?
A lot of teens and young adults go online as their first stop to find information about sexual health. And that's part of the reason that these policies are so problematic. And I do want to point out also that, you know, it's not, these policies are absolutely a reflection of our greater culture and how we deal with sex, which is kind of the bury your head in the sand approach, right? There's sex on billboards everywhere, but we don't actually want to talk about it. So it's not just a problem with social media, it's a problem across the board culturally, and these social media regulations really just reflect that greater culture.
Well, give us a read on the sexual health of teens and young adults. We've heard a lot of news about teen births having decreased a great deal since the 1990s. Can you give us more specifics on that?
Yeah, STDs and unplanned pregnancies are still a huge, huge issue in this country. And the healthcare-related costs for unplanned pregnancies and STDs combined is over double what we spend for childhood obesity. So we're talking about an amazing, you know, economic cost for all of this.
What are those figures?
So every year, the United States spends $16 billion in healthcare costs related to STDs and $12 billion in healthcare costs related to teen pregnancy. And beyond the economic costs of these things, obviously, STDs and unplanned pregnancies are not something that people want to deal with. And when you look at the rates of STDs and unplanned pregnancy in this country, they are so much higher than almost every other country in the developed world. So when you look at Europe, their rates are much lower. And in general, the culture in Europe is one that is a little more permissible around sexual issues. So it's more okay to talk about sex. And I think that it's no coincidence that in a culture where they're more open about sex, people are better able to protect themselves from pregnancy and STDs. So after writing this article and getting all this information, it really started to bother me, right? As I'm sure many journalists have that experience when they write about something that seems so wrong. So I actually started a petition on change.org to get social media giants to meet with sexual health educators, and together we can figure out some policies that will work for them and will keep, you know, a lot of pornography off of their channels, but will also allow for sexual health messages to come through.
Well, Amber Madison, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Amber Madison, she's a therapist and sex educator and lecturer and writer who wrote When Social Media Companies Censor Sex Education. We found it on The Atlantic. You can find a link to read it for yourself and also a link to her petition on change.org. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a defense of online-only relationships. A millennial argues that our digital connections are just as real and as meaningful as our face-to-face bonds. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, meeting a partner through an online dating service isn't at all unusual, but there is still something unconventional about relationships that never transition from the screen to the coffee shop, right? Maybe that's why we qualify online-only bonds as he's my Twitter friend or we're friends on Facebook. The implication is that digital relations, platonic or otherwise, are distinct from those in real life. The freelance writer Kyle Chayka says it's time to do away with that distinction. He recently wrote a defense of online intimacy for The New Republic. Kyle, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Now, this is not that conventional idea, you know, that we say online relationships are sort of stepping stones to face-to-face relationships. You're making a point that there's really no difference. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point these days is that a lot of relationships, or all relationships, kind of cross freely between online space and offline. So, you know, whether you're interacting with someone you only know from Twitter or with a husband or wife, you're still interacting with them online.
But are you interacting in them in the same way, those same qualities that people often ascribe to face-to-face relationships as opposed to online relationships?
Yeah, I think there are some very fundamental differences with how people interact in person versus online. But if we're talking about interacting with people and speaking with them and kind of having an intellectual dialogue with them, I think there's actually a lot to be said for having that online conversation.
Why, is there a disinhibition in not seeing somebody, or what's different?
I think there is a degree of disinhibition, and that can sometimes be bad, you know, if you feel free to insult a writer or someone whose opinion you don't like on the internet. But I think it also frees up our expectations a little bit. It makes us maybe more willing to consider other people's viewpoints or different subjects that we wouldn't normally come across in everyday life.
Do you have any online-only relationships?
I do. I was just actually talking with a journalist I know in London, and I've never met him in real life, but we talk constantly. Mm-hmm. And that's because we know each other from Twitter and kind of have built up this relationship. But actually, most of my friends in New York City, where I live, I've actually first met online and then gradually got to know them and then transitioned into having this very real life relationship.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's the conventional route that a lot of people think of. But I guess looking at your relationship with this friend in London, so what do you think when somebody says that isn't a real world relationship? It's not real life.
Well, I think it is real life in that so many of our interactions happen online these days that the internet does comprise real life. But if someone were to say that, I mean, we we carry out so many relationships over the phone with family members or over Skype. I think not necessarily having that face-to-face interaction is a pretty usual thing. So I feel that it's completely real.
One way that people do distinguish online and physical relationships is this idea of trust, right? The idea that online, your 50-year-old boyfriend could be a 25-year-old scammer, or your beautiful young girlfriend could be a middle-aged man. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think in my article I talked about this a bit, but earlier on in the internet's history, maybe in the late 80s or 90s, there was a lot more anonymity in chat rooms or IRC channels, so you were less likely to actually know who you were talking to. But I think these days, when you encounter someone online, you can kind of do a background check on them. You can look up their Facebook account. You can look at their Instagram. You can get a much better sense of their real-life identity than you could before. And I think that builds to a better sense of trust between people on the internet, since we all have this kind of mutual responsibility to be our authentic selves on Facebook or on Twitter.
We've heard an awful lot of conversations, right, in the past, you know, 15 years progressively about how the internet is changing the way that we interact as a society, both online and off. Do you think, Kyle, that's a generational debate, that younger millennials wouldn't even think this is a conversation worth having?
I do think that. I mean, I think with people who have grown up with the internet, it's a lot easier to think of a relationship as transitioning between online and off. But I do think this debate is always going to happen. You know, now I find myself a little bit freaked out by Snapchat or something. And I think, you know, that's just not quite my generation. But each generation has its own forms of communication and its own ways of building relationships. And I think, I mean, that's something that's always going to change. And all we can do is accept that whatever people feel is authentic or real.
This all does remind me of a conversation that I had with Sherry Turkle on this program. And she was saying that we have this illusion of intimacy in the online world without the demands of friendship. Do you feel like you value those relationships differently, online and off? You don't have to work so hard online as you might in the real world.
That is true. I mean, it is easier to maintain online friendships often. But I think something that the journalist Jenna Wortham points out in my article is that the internet kind of allows us to have different shades of relationships. So rather than limiting us to, you know, a very deep, very intimate, lifelong friendship with someone who we see face to face all the time, the internet kind of does allow us to have these more ambient relationships that happen over the course of months or years. And maybe you don't meet face to face, but social networks enable you to have this ongoing dialogue with people who you would never have a chance to meet. And I think that's extremely valuable.
Kyle Chayka, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Kyle Chayka is a freelance journalist, and his piece, Let's Really Be Friends, A Defense of Online Intimacy, was in the New Republic. There's a link to read it and to the New York Times debate that it inspired at wordofmouthradio.org.
Oh, I'd love to climb to mountains, reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. I'd love to go out fishing.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, online dating is not really anything to blush about these days, but it's taken years for that stigma to dissipate, which is surprising when you consider the number of couples who met through the infinitely more awkward method of the blind date. In 1950, Gail Burton was going to nursing school when she reluctantly went on a triple blind date. She had no idea she was about to meet her husband-to-be, a college student named Frank Newby. A few years ago, they talked about their first encounter for StoryCorps.
I'd spent all the afternoon of the date sunbathing. I was red as a beet. My hair was a mess, and I really didn't want to go. And as we were walking down the stairs, I saw the three guys sitting there, and I said to my friend, "Look at the hick with no tie. I'll bet I get stuck with him." And I did. We went out, and I knew he didn't have any money. they wanted to stop for a hamburger and a Coke, and he just frankly told me, I can't afford it. Somehow or other, that seemed honest to me. I said, let's just sit in the car and talk. And talk we did. Talked ourselves right into love and marriage. And then I called him, and we decided maybe we wanted to see each other again. But friends from Chicago had come in, and they took me out to lunch. So I stood him up.
I waited longer for her that day than I've ever waited for anybody in my life. I don't think I really was mad. I was disgusted, and I just wrote this girl off. And so I went back to work, worked Monday night, worked Tuesday night. And Wednesday evening, the manager said, Frank, you've got a telephone call. And in her little girl voice, she started explaining to me. And the sucker that I was, I accepted the apology. And on Friday, I took her out to the farm to meet my mother and dad. And I told Dad Saturday, if you can find us a minister, we're going to get married tomorrow. And on the honeymoon, we got halfway to Lake Schaefer, and I discovered that I only had $20.
So we honeymooned on $20, and it was fun.
We found a motel for $3 a night. We discovered a beer garden where you get a hamburger and a bottle of beer for, I think, 75 cents. So we lived 3 days and three nights.
On hamburger, beer, and love. And I've never once regretted a three-day courtship.
Gail and Frank Newby there, who at the time of that recording had been married for 57 years. Their interview and all StoryCorps interviews are archived at the Library of Congress. There's more word of mouth coming up after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sometimes the most remarkable jobs are the ones no one notices working, unless they get it wrong. Today's Good Gig segment highlights stunning visual displays and illumination by a person who is oddly invisible. From high-grossing concerts to Olympic ceremonies to comedy specials to Broadway openings to Super Bowl halftime shows, Laura Frank creates spectacle. Laura crafts and edits and figures out how to project lighting and video effects made on computers into the environment. The effect is Luminous, and that's the name of her business, Luminous FX. And Laura Frank is today's Good Gig guest. Welcome to Word of Mouth, Laura.
Hi, Virginia.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here, but I had trouble coming up with a title for you. I left it blank. What are you, a designer, a technician?
I'm currently floating around the title screens producer. So in some way, if you have screens on your live entertainment event, be they projection or LED, you need someone to produce the workflow. So lately, another term that gets floated around a lot is workflow engineer for video. Again, that's a very amorphous, vague term, meaning if you have video that's part of your scenery, you need someone to think about how it's engineered as well as how it's created. So it's a very left brain, right brain job, which I thrive in.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about those two halves of the brain and two halves of what you do. How did you get into this kind of work?
I caught the theater bug early. I'm going to say early in high school, I started doing summer theater programs. But while I was in school, I was participating in theater, but I was also in AP science classes. So somewhere I had to reconcile my love of technology and science with my love of the theater. And so it was very natural for me to end up pursuing lighting, because that was the most high-tech of the environments in the theater world that I enjoyed. Following college, I ended up working for a company called Verilight, and they were the first to come on the scene with robotic lighting gear, lights that could change color, pan and tilt, project patterns, And these systems typically on a big rock tour will number 500 to 800 fixtures. And there are people who specialize, like I do, in just the varying control systems that can do this kind of work. At some point, I was looking for new challenges, and I started studying Photoshop and After Effects and web development in anticipation that there was going to be an explosion of the skills needed in my particular industry. So I always knew I was going to be a part of the entertainment industry. I was just always looking for the most interesting technology and gear to play with.
Well, you certainly pegged it right. I went through and looked at some of the fascinating work, some huge scale work that you've done. One of the things I found, the Paul McCartney Super Bowl halftime show. Now let's listen to just a bit from this. So I want to just remind listeners that when Paul McCartney was playing, there was this kind of cruciform shaped stage, and all of these images of the performance and other images, I'm kind of remembering a monster truck during Baby, You Can Drive My Car, projected onto this. So Laura, what was your role in putting this together?
Actually, for the Paul McCartney halftime show, I was on the lighting team. So if you remember from the video clips, there were these massive kind of arced lighting structures that flames would shoot off of. Those were all moved in position by 500 volunteers during the halftime break. And so my job on that was the lighting programming of that part of the system and making sure you could see the band and create all the visual effects out of the lighting gear for that show.
So what do you do when that performance is over and all of the smoke from the fireworks has dissipated? You just say, phew, you know, what does your crew do after a performance of that scale live is done?
We go to the bar. Wait, no, we've already been to the bar. It's really stressful. We constantly have to remind each other that we're not saving lives. This is entertainment. And we're here because we thrive on the challenge and we love working hard. And there is always a stress release component at the end of the show. So, you know, we go blow some steam and most people are already prepping their next gigs and trying to figure out what's the next new thing. But it's an interesting group of people. We're not quite carnies. We're not quite circus people, but we are definitely somewhere between mercenaries and theater geeks.
Well, how about that other moment when things first come onto stage? Here's a clip of that precise thing from George Lopez's comedy special for HBO.
You must be successful. You can get Mexicans to get out of their chairs. Because we never get up. No, I'm not going to get up my feet. I can't. I have certain. Look at my veins. They're popping out. I can't. I don't want to stand up because they're going to take my chair and belong.
So it was just, for some reason, this one really struck me because, you know, they're playing this sort of intro to Low Rider and he's got, you know, there's a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. He hits a stage. There's this big surge. God, you know, I watched that, Laura, and I feel just this surge of emotion. Does that ever diminish for you?
It is so hard to describe those first few minutes because there's the part of you that is like technically, mentally supporting all that computer gear, begging it to please work. And then there's the part of you that like can feel the tension in the audience rising. It's a magic moment, but you also have to be so focused because you want to see it go and work properly that I have to disengage a little bit from that. There is one moment, though, I can describe that perfectly encompasses what I think you're talking about, which is I used to work for David Bowie, and in his last tours, he was the curator of the Glastonbury Festival in 2000. And I had not done a lot of big rock tours, and the Glastonbury Festival in England is tens of thousands of people in the audience. And you're on this tower in the center of that sea of people, and you've got the lighting control desk, the video control desk, and you have all these screens and lights in front of you. And there's a particular kind of light called an audience blinder. And it's a bunch of aircraft landing lights just pointed at the audience. And it's just designed to blind them. And I hit that like the minute before David walked on stage. And the whole audience roared. And my heart just, it skipped a beat. It's just this magical moment that I kept doing it. I was like, wait, is that me? Is that Bowie? Like, what's happening? And it's immensely powerful, that feeling.
Wow, that sounds so amazing. And I'm wondering, when watching these clips that I did of the David Bowie tour or Madonna, these huge productions, how many people it takes to put together something like that?
Oh, God. It depends on the event. Like, I'm trying to think of his name. Moby. Sorry, Moby's mm-hmm. Area Tour. When he did Area 2, I know it was 250 people we were touring to support five acts. It's amazing, but you're absolutely right. We are invisible unless we make a mistake. And so that's always my goal, is to, you know, keep the machine moving and make ourselves invisible.
I'm talking with Laura Frank as part of our Good Gig series, and she has a pretty great gig, creating stunning visual displays and illumination for everything from major concerts to Olympic ceremonies to comedy specials to Broadway openings. And Laura, I want to go back to that moment when you switched on the audience lights at Glastonbury and your role in creating that experience, which seems so powerful. Now, how much of that is technical and how much of it is creative or artistry?
I can't extricate one from the other. It's a very hybrid approach to the visual work. So I can't separate the creative thought from the technical process. So I'm not purely a designer. The term I most easily use is editor, because I work with other designers and creative sources to get what I think is the best result the most efficiently. So in that moment, you know, some of it's gut instinct and, you know, the input I've gotten from the other creative teams, and some of it's just like little technical cheats I know work really well to accomplish something quickly. Because a show like Glastonbury, I may have, you know, midnight to 4 a.m. to program the lighting display for a 90-minute concert. So you have to work the system.
Well, Laura, you've mentioned you've done a lot of television. You've done Broadway shows. You're working on Matilda the musical, based on the Roald Dahl children's story now. And you've also done a lot of film work. You had a cameo role in The School of Rock. Is there a particular medium that you prefer working with?
I would say live rock music or live concerts are possibly my favorite. I find when I'm in a live music environment that's purely about the audience that's present, it's an incredible experience, possibly because I'm in TV so much. But just the range of colors you can get when it's the human eye versus a camera looking at the stage becomes magic. The audience response, as we were talking about, that's immediate, which you don't get when you're dealing with cameras. But there are fewer bands touring now. I don't have access to those types of gigs the way I used to.
I went back and watched the opening ceremonies for Vancouver Olympics in 2012. You also worked on the Salt Lake City Olympic opening ceremonies. It was just amazing. And I'd kind of forgotten this. You know, there was this effect of a storm cloud gathering in the center of the stadium. And then a run of whales appeared to be swimming on the floor of the stadium below. Then these First Nation symbols. Just a huge, huge production. What is the biggest production you've ever done?
The Olympic events are incredible because they're a real international celebration. I value those immensely that I've been able to work on them. But I have to say, possibly the experience nearest and dearest to my heart is David Bowie's last tour, his reality tour, 2003 and 2004. Because sitting with him talking about what this visual display was going to be, his advice was, you know, I don't care if we use this incredibly expensive scenic display for three songs. As soon as we've upstaged the band or the music, we failed. And I've taken that perspective with me to everything I do, because, you know, the science of the human eye, as I've read about it and people's experience of watching television, the fastest moving imagery is where your attention goes. It's reptilian for us. It's your fight or flight response that gets engaged. So my goal is always, with that visual display, not to distract, but to be present and support the artistry that's happening. And that's not the screens. That's the people on stage. There can be moments where that can overtake the experience. I think that's a great example from the Vancouver Games, where the whole stadium turned into the ocean. But for me, that should be the rare case, not the primary experience of the visual display.
Well, Laura, you've said so many things that make me extremely covetous of your fantastic gig. Why do you think it's such a good gig?
I think the community is an amazing experience to share the production experience with people. So community is really important to me, and I thrive on the technical challenge. I don't get to interact with the artists all the time. It's not about the stardom for me. It's mountain climbing in its own way. The technical hurdles and the experience of being live and all these people watching on television together for this shared experience, it's powerful.
Laura Frank, it's so fascinating hearing what you do after seeing so much of your work and not even knowing it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
Okay, Laura Frank is you fill in the blank. You can find much more on the work that she's done with Luminous Effects, her company, at wordofmouthradio.org. And from lighting superstars on stage to how one intrepid reporter tried to cast a small-town pariah in a new light. That story when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The town outcast. Seems every small community has one. But like Boo Radley, these pariahs are often misunderstood. Victims of gossip turned legend, which become fear. As producer Galen Koch discovered, all it can take is a conversation to discover that there is more to the town pariah than those scary stories. And she brings us this story.
When Mike Silverstein was a kid, he used to summer on the coast of Maine, in the small resort town of Ocean Point. In the winter, the town is quiet. The shingled mini-mansions overlooking the open water are boarded up. The wind howls off the rough Atlantic Sea. There's something that makes this town different from other coastal Maine retreats. Something that made summers here even more exciting for a little kid like Mike. In Ocean Point, there's a boogeyman. He's a real person. And his name is Bobby Moore. I've heard lots of stories about Bobby. Folks in town say that over 20 years ago, kids would shut their windows on even the hottest summer nights for fear that Bobby Moore would get them. People say that Bobby starts fires under summer cottages. He walks in the woods on paths behind people's homes and peeks in their windows. He's a lecher, a pedophile, a stalker. It's hard to know which stories are true. The only concrete evidence against Bobby Moore is that in the mid-90s he was convicted of arson. The details of the fire are hazy to most people in town, but many folks who know Bobby say that yes, he is dangerous. Despite warnings from his neighbors, I want to meet Bobby. I want to know why he's demonized and why he still lives in a town where he seems so utterly alone. I'm not going to see Bobby by myself. I'm bringing my friend Pete along, just in case the boogeyman is as scary as everyone claims.
Bob, nice to meet you, Pete.
Nice to meet you.
Bobby, or Bob as he likes to be called, greets us in his trailer. The beige mobile home doesn't fit in with the classic Maine capes and million-dollar summer mansions in town. Bobby's home is small, with sparse furniture that looks like it's been here since 1980. Neat rows of mason jars line the windowsills, each one filled with pebbles, sea glass, and shells.
Gosh, how long have you been collecting these rocks, Bobby?
Since I moved down, my wife moved down here in October of 1982.
Dozens of Disney figurines adorn a shelf in the kitchen. Folk records line the living room walls. And as for the boogeyman, well, he stands about 5'5", and he's 63 years old. People say Bob is mentally ill. He didn't verify that fact, but it seems likely that he's on the autism spectrum. He doesn't look you in the eye when he talks. He rocks back and forth from the knees obsessively, and he has a tendency to invade personal space. Bob's undeniably friendly, and within 20 minutes of entering his home, he's seated in the living room, tuning his guitar.
Bobby out of tune a little bit. I played it. That good of voice, but everybody sounds better than Bob Dylan, I think. Go away from my window, go at your own chosen speed.
Bob taught himself to play music entirely by ear. He's a guitarist and a pianist. He doesn't have a piano at home, so he visits local churches and public spaces to play. Talking to Bob, it's clear that he feels isolated. He's been yelled at and teased since he moved here in the 80s.
So, Bobby, you were saying in the town you don't have that many people don't come over and visit.
Unless they really don't, to tell you the truth. A couple of, I call them a pub of punks in the town. He's down there, so some guys, I'd be just walking down the beach. They'd say, hey, Bob. They go, give me the middle finger, say, F you to me, or hey, you bastard, or whatever. And I'd mind my own business. And
why do you think they yell at you like that?
Probably because I'm a loner, for one thing, by myself.
There's another reason why people torment Bob, why they're afraid of him. People think that Bob sets fires. He was rumored to have started numerous fires in town, but he was only sent to jail for one of these alleged crimes. In the mid-90s, Bob was living with his wife, Bonnie, and reporting the weather from Ocean Point for WCSH Portland. Bob would row between the islands and the bay, calling in the weather report and collecting pebbles and shells.
All I know is I went out to the White Island on the morning of June 10th. I try to remember this just like it was yesterday, even though it was almost 20 years ago. And I had already gone to bed, and Bonnie was here, my wife was here watching television. And we heard a knock on the door, and Bonnie said, Bob, she said, the cops are here. And they said, Bobby, we want to talk to you. Said, why'd you go this morning, your boat? I said, I went out to White Island, landed on there looking for sea glass and shells. And you're a goddamn liar, Bobby. You set a fire on Fishman's Island last night. I said, of course they didn't. I said, of course not. And that's when the trouble started. They started hollering at me and to manipulate me, coerce me, coercement and interrogation and whatever. And I kind of wimped out. I wish I had. And I said, I never set that fire. I don't know anything about it. You were seen rolling out there, Bobby, near Fishman's Island. I said, broke down. I got scared. And I said, I kept saying I never set that fire.
Bob was convicted of arson, sent to jail for 6 years, and was on probation for another 6 years. During that time, he tried to return to Ocean Point, but the town sent a letter to his parole officer, begging that Bobby's restraining order remain in effect. During his jail time, Bonnie divorced him, and Bob finally moved back to Ocean Point in 2006 to live in his trailer alone.
If I could make all the Ocean Pointers see down here, and I never set the fire or whatever, maybe I'd have some friends down here, whatever.
West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home.
I did speak with one man who considers Bob more a friend, the Reverend Bobby Ives. Bobby used to run the Carpenter's Boat Shop, a socialist boat school that Bob still visits once a month. Bobby Ives told me more details about the events leading up to the arson in 94. Fisherman Island was sold in the early 90s to a family after over 100 years under the same owner. According to Bobby Ives, Bob Moore rode out to the island one morning like always and was told to leave the property and never come back. Folks think he took that to heart. That he went to the island the next evening and started a small fire in one of the empty homes as revenge.
But I think that Bob was so angry and so upset that he might not even have known he did it and could plead not guilty. The only reason I say that, I've seen other individuals who have very similar situations are just out of control, or in terms of their mind, it was so deep that they didn't even realize what they had done. Speculation of one simple main folk who's sharing with you a story.
Bobby Ives didn't tell me if he thinks Bob started the fire. But it's not hard to imagine that, with enough provocation, after so many years of taunting and isolation, Bob could have had a violent episode. Bob is still accused of crimes in Ocean Point. Just last summer, the community blamed him for a series of break-ins, until the burglar was found, months later, and Bob's name was cleared.
He'll have to bear that the rest of his life. You cannot clear that up.
Bob has a deep connection to the sea and the geography of Ocean Point.
Why did you come back?
Well, because I kind of liked it down here.
It's the one place he has to call home. After the interview, he takes us for a walk to the beach to collect stones.
I think the tide's starting to come in now. I want to step on the low tide drop.
Yeah, let's go down. You want to go down there?
Oh, sure.
Bob is peaceful as he watches waves break on the rocks, He gives me two clear pieces of sea glass and two small bits of white china.
Look at those. You found those so quickly.
Those are yours. Those are yours. And peace.
For Salt Radio, I'm Galen Koch.
It's white quartz or whatever. That's why I call this Treasure Beach. Yeah, this is the best beach in the point.
Break me, baby. No, no, no.
And that story was produced by Galen Koch. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show or have trouble catching Word of Mouth in the middle of the day, you can catch up with the show in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.